Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. As we enter the dog days of summer, let's get out of the kitchen and into the backyard for a grilling adventure with David Guas, host of the Travel Channel's new show, American Grill. And of course, we're going to wash that barbecue down with a cold brew. But this week, we're going upmarket in our swilling choices with help from Polly Watts of the Avenue Pub. Then, for the perfect summer dessert, we head to Shreveport for a ghostickle. Light the fire and prepare to cool off on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I think the thing that a lot of people who are not incredibly familiar with beer find surprising when they first start drinking beer is what a broad range of flavor profiles you have. If they're coming from a wine background, they're used to two major flavor profiles, white and red, and there are variances in between that, and then of course you got the dessert wines, the sauternes and things. But for the most part, it's white or red, right? Beer styles are much, much more divergent. The difference between a sour beer and a hoppy beer and a barley wine are dramatically different. So it's not unusual for people, especially as they're just learning about beer, to discover that they really love one or two styles, but they don't necessarily, there are a bunch that they don't necessarily love.
When it comes to craft beer, Polly Watts is a treasure trove of knowledge. As the proprietor of the Avenue Pub, she's personally responsible for having overhauled the bar's beer choices, going from pedestrian mass-produced brews to a truly international craft beer selection. Since then, business has boomed, and Polly never looked back. That's why she was the perfect person to further my beer education. You see, even though I've toured some of the most exclusive French champagne caves, my beer tastes have been pretty much limited to a cold Miller High Life on the fishing boat. That's why, on a brutally humid afternoon, I tucked into the Avenue Pub, pulled up a bar stool, and let Polly take it from there.
This is an Imperial Porter. This is a little bit cold, so you would want to warm it a little bit with your hand before you drink it. Cold tends to mask nuances, and it enhances bittering qualities. So that tradition of putting a beer in a cold glass, in a refrigerated glass, will actually make a beer more bitter than it was intended to be. Now, sometimes people really like that. But most people, especially if they're fairly new to craft beer, the whole hops and bitterness is an evolution. And they taste it, and it's not for them. They just had it served to them at 10 degrees warmer, they probably would have liked it.
I do not have the beer education to properly describe what I'm tasting. So would you please explain what I should be experiencing, what I'm looking for as I'm drinking and tasting these beers?
Well, it's funny. I think in beer, and although there are some people who would absolutely that answer that question without caveat, I honestly think that beer is just about enjoying yourself. So we give menu descriptions and we tell people things they could look for as a guide for, are you going to like it before you order it? Our beers are too expensive to give out free samples of, so we don't do that. Every person's palate is completely different, and women's are dramatically different than men. They taste different things in the same beer. So I'm always hesitant to tell people what they should taste, because in the long run, it doesn't matter what the piece of paper says or what I say. It's whether or not, did you enjoy drinking it? And you can put all kinds of wacky descriptors on something, but it comes down to, when I finished that glass, did I enjoy that experience or did I not? That said, Evil Twin, Little B, is a Danish gypsy brewer who is now brewing out of one or more breweries in Connecticut. It's an imperial porter. I would say that it's creamy chocolate. The malts are roasted and has vanilla fudge and a faint dark fruit presence.
I taste all those things. I love, love, love. I have to admit, it's the beer for drinking and not necessarily for just knocking back crawfish with. This is just something that it's like dessert to me. It really is.
Well, it's almost as strong as many wines. It's 11.2% ABV. So if you drank a wine bottle of that, you would feel like you had just drunk a bottle of wine.
As Polly talked to me about the different types of glasses she uses to serve beer, I cupped the brandy snifter she'd given me in the palm of my hand. As the evil twin continued to warm, its chocolate flavor brightened with a fruity subtlety I could taste on the tip of my tongue. I could have stuck with that one for a while, but with all the beers for tasting, lingering on just one was out of the question. Okay, is there an order that one should taste beers in?
There is not an order one should taste beers in. There is an order in which one should not taste beers in. So hoppy beers, which you probably have heard of, are called IPAs. Hops are palate killers in large quantities. And there are times where I actually put on the menu, please do not make this your first beer. This needs to be your last beer. Because once you drink this, you will not be able to taste anything else. Sort of like hot sauce and food. You know how when you buy those 5-alarm chicken wings and your mouth tastes nothing for the next 4 hours?
Yeah.
Hoppy beers are somewhat like that. And if you read some of the names that brewers assign to them, Green Flash does a double IPA, which is more hops and more hops, that they actually call palate wrecker. Stone does an IPA, which they're very famous for, that's called Ruination. And it's named that because it ruins your palate. So if you're going to drink something other than hops during a drinking session when you come to the pub or at home, you don't want to start with hops. You want that to finish your tasting because you won't taste the nuances, either good or bad, if you blow your palate with hops early on. IPA is India Pale Ale. Within the IPA range, there are different types of IPAs. And whether they're West Coast, Belgian, English, or East Coast, sort of the four main ones. And that has to do with what kind of yeast is used. If a Belgian yeast was used, it's typically it's a Belgian IPA. English IPAs, and they originated the style, are done with different hops as a general rule than American IPAs. Well, Americans took the form and they amped it up and put it on steroids. They use very piney, resiny. I mean, there are some IPAs that it's like chewing on a pine tree at times. And people love that. West Coast IPA tends to go more towards the piney and citrus. East Coast IPAs tend to go more towards floral. English IPAs tend to be more balanced. And all these varietals are organic. So when you hear words like Simcoe, Centennial, Galaxy, Mount Hood, all the different hop varietals, those are a plant, in case people don't know. The hop is the flower. And the particular variety of plant, just like you would have a particular variety of mushroom that would taste completely different, depending on whether it's a, you know, an oyster mushroom or a morel, hops are the same way. They have different amounts of bitterness, different amounts of other flavors. Galaxy hops has a lot of blackberry in it, so you get that blackberry note when you use a lot of Galaxy. And they flavor a beer differently. There are IPAs, like Palate Wrecker, that are like a sledgehammer to the senses. This is still an IPA, but it's completely different. It's a West Coast IPA, which means it employs primarily piney and citrus hops, with a very low yeast presence. So you don't really taste the yeast. The yeast isn't part of the flavor profile in this kind of beer in the way that it would be in an English and Belgian IPA.
In all honesty, the West Coast IPA didn't do it for me. It had a beautiful aroma, but the flavor packed a punch that startled my taste buds. It was a bit like going from the kiddie pool to suddenly being thrown in the deep end. When Polly saw the expression on my face, I apologetically explained that usually wine is my game. With a smile, she pulled out a corked bottle that looked like it could have come from the Loire Valley.
She peeled back the foil wrapper, popped the cork, and poured me a glass.
This beer is spontaneously fermented, but then it is aged in wine barrels, except that those wine barrels are about the size of this room. They're massive. Literally, you can crawl inside of them. The other thing that's kind of interesting is that you tend to think of beer as being made in a batch, right? And then you pour, you know, you'd extract that batch and put it into a keg or a bottle. Sour beers, like lambics and gooses, are blended. So the brewing process takes place, and then they get aged. And then the blender, and that's as much a part of the art as the brewing, will go to each one of the barrels, and it's a traditional wine barrel size, and they will taste each one of them and decide, I'm going to blend A with B with C to get the perfect flavor profile. And that's where the flavor profiles come. So when you hear in terms of lambics and gooses, a big, big part of the flavor profile has to do with the palate of the man or woman who blended it. And that is a dying art. Your palate has to be perfect. And there aren't that many people in the world that can do it. And I'll tell you something else that helps a lot of people who understand wine much better than I do. There's a movement within wine called the biodynamic movement. There's a movement within beer that's biodynamic. They don't use the words biodynamic, but that beer that you have in front of you is made by one of very, very few traditional Belgian brewers that uses what's called spontaneous fermentation. Now, the modern brewing method is that you add yeast, you inoculate a beer, and the yeast strain that you use determines a great deal of the flavor profile. The traditional sour beers from Belgium in the Seine Valley are all spontaneously fermented, the way you see some wines and champagnes in the biodynamic movement. It's all locally harvested fruits. If they're going to use a fruit in the beer, no sugar added, no sulfites, no stabilizers, all handmade. Every bit of yeast that kickstarts that fermentation, on which the fermentation builds, comes from the air. So there's this old story. Cantillon is the best known sour brewer in the world. There was this old story that Jean Van Roy had a couch in his open fermentation room, and it was old and it was very nasty, and his wife wanted to replace it. And he was afraid that if he got rid of the couch that his beer would not taste as good. Because it's the bugs that are coming from, you know, the rafters and the couch, you know, all in the air, they give it that flavor profile. So they're brewing in a building that they've been brewing in for 100 years. So it's 100 years of that sort of yeast development. I mean, if the building burned down, literally, the beer could no longer exist.
There's such a direct tie between that and bread.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
The multi-generational originator of the poor boy, the John Gendusa family, John told me that when they moved from downtown to Mirabeau Avenue, his dad actually brought some of the bread dough from down there and smeared it around on the bricks and the walls to make sure that everything was going to stay the same in the air.
Right, and that doesn't surprise me a bit because yeast is everywhere. I mean, it's ever present. And I think part of what I liked about learning about craft beer, and it's educated me on learning about other spirits, is that yeast is a big part of the taste profile that we like or don't like. And as beer drinkers, we're used to talking about that. It's also a huge factor in whiskey, in bourbon. And most people don't even think of the yeast strain as being an important part of why they may like Maker's Mark versus Four Roses versus something out of the Jim Beam or Buffalo Trace Sazerac collections. And a lot of it has to do with that underlying yeast strain. So if you get to the point where you can kind of taste things and think, okay, well, I like that yeast strain and I don't like that, then that opens up a whole lot of other possibilities in terms of trying things and knowing ahead of time whether or not you're going to like them or not.
Now let's review. Porters and stouts are served warmer than you'd expect. Save your IPAs till the end of the evening, and try a Goose Lambic if you're a wine lover like me. You can give them all a try at the Avenue Pub in New Orleans, or a craft beer bar in your neighborhood. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats.
Down at the corner beer joint, dancing to the rock and roll. sister likes to do it, Lord, sister likes to move her soul. Down at the corner beer joint, dancing on a hardwood floor. Oh, well, the jeans fit a little bit tighter than they did before.
What are the four ingredients found in all beer? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back.
Her jeans fit a little bit tighter than they did before. She likes to move her soul.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What are the four ingredients found in all beer? To make any kind of beer, you need hops, barley, yeast, and water. Arguably, yeast is the ingredient that can most affect the flavor. Hundreds of species of yeast are used in brewing beer across the world. Each species acts a little different from the others. Some are incredibly efficient at eating sugar, converting more of the sweet stuff into alcohol and CO2 than the others. Lager yeasts, for example, tend to be better than ale yeasts at eating sugar. This means that lagers come out of the fermentation tank drier and with more alcohol than they would have had if an ale yeast had been used. Some leave behind flavors that are essential to the style. For instance, ale yeast is used to make Hefeweizen and is responsible for the clove and banana aromas and flavors that make this style so distinguishable. Other yeasts are used specifically because they're less efficient fermenters and allow the barley flavor to shine through by leaving more fermentable sugars in the wort. But even though yeast probably has the most effect on the finished product, without hops, barley, and water, there'd be no beer. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Until this summer, David Guas was probably best known for his career as pastry chef and owner of Bayou Bakery in Arlington, Virginia. A frequent guest on NBC's Today Show, David recently made the jump to television host of the Travel Channel's American Grilled. We sat down with David in the studio, where he talked about his early backyard grilling experiences with his dad and how he's gone on to become the host of a competitive grilling show.
Growing up in New Orleans, my father was the weekend warrior. He was the guy in the backyard constantly. So I actually grew up around a grill. You know, it's not necessarily something that I did professionally, but I mean, I was patting out hamburgers at the age of six with my dad. And, you know, to this day, he still has one of the same grills that he had then. It's a 39, 40-year-old grill, and he now lives in Florida and still has that grill. In fact, shortly after I got the gig to do the show, you know, he took a picture of the grill because I was being interviewed talking about this particular grill. So he sent it to me. You know, he's done some refurbishing and sort of put some love in it over the years, but the cast, the sort of cavity of the grill is the same. And to me, you know, we had a pool growing up out in the East, and a lot of memories are surrounded by being in a bathing suit and grilling. My dad made a phenomenal barbecue chicken. You know, burgers, of course, were great, but, you know, pretty common. But his pork, you know, anytime he did like a tenderloin, kind of reminding himself of Cuba, he'd make a mojo and he'd put a little smoke on it. And so I always remember like him being very methodical and sort of passionate about it, but still there were some very clear do's and don'ts. And so I learned those kind of things without even knowing that I was learning them, you know, obviously. But, you know, the whole Travel Channel thing, it came up, you know, they were looking for a host. They're in my backyard. They're based in Bethesda, Maryland, just outside of Chevy Chase area. And the executive producer, you know, called me up. A friend of a friend sort of gave him my name. And next thing you know, one of the executive producers came in to the restaurant, had my arm drip, which is our roast beef po' boy. And the guy kind of, you know, Patrick McManamy, he sort of had it. And he was just like, he couldn't talk. He was like, wow, this is amazing. He's like, it's not grilled, but it's amazing. And that's, we just started talking. We talked for 2 hours. And later that same day, at about 6:30 that evening, he called me up on my cell phone and said, hey, it's Patrick. And I said, hey, how are you? I said, you know, you still thinking about that sandwich? He said, actually, yes, I am. And he goes, but that's not why I'm calling. I'm calling because I want to know if you want to make a show. Let's do it. So within the same day, he had made a decision and rolled the dice, and here we are.
Boy, there must have been a lot of jumping up and down and happy dancing going on in your house.
There was a lot of hooting and hollering, that's for sure. I got two boys that were just besides themselves, so it was a lot of fun, great news.
Well, you know, I love that somehow you have ended up in this spot where you're getting to combine two things that you love mm-hmm. on your television show, mm-hmm. travel and food.
That's right.
So where have you been?
13 cities, 13 shows. So every city represents an episode and a show. I got to go to places in the U.S. that I either had never been or haven't been in 15, 20 years. So for me, it was this wonderful way to sort of – because, you know, we don't – you know, in the restaurant business, I'm sort of glued to my restaurant. I don't travel a lot. And so this was a wonderful, wonderful excuse
yeah.
to get out and see the country. And, of course, we were here in New Orleans, which was, you know, an amazing episode. It was just, you know, obviously – wonderful to be back home and doing this show here at the French Market. But we were in Austin, we were in Memphis, St. Louis, we were in Chicago, we were in Asheville, we were all over. It was just, I fell in love with Asheville. It reminded me so much of New Orleans. It had this wonderful sort of funky arts community, and it had the mountains there. They call it sort of the Berkeley of the South. And I actually fell in love with a lot of different cities for different reasons. But, you know, we had a full-on culinary team that traveled with us. So we had a chef and his whole sous chef crew, and they were waking up at 5 and going to the farmers markets in the cities we were in and finding local produce and local proteins and things like that that were within, you know, 50-plus miles and bringing it to the show. So not only were they sort of stocked in the larder, but they were also part of our reveal ingredients. So well, that's what made it real.
That was really fascinating to me also was the way you all incorporated unique indigenous ingredients mm-hmm. into each one of the competitions. And so did that just happen on the fly, spur of the moment, or how much planning
that
went
was
into
sort of
that?
The brainchild of Neil DeGroote and Patrick McManamy. Neil was the showrunner and Patrick being one of the executives from Travel. That's the way they wanted this to begin with. They wanted it to be like a show that hadn't been before, obviously. And how do we make it to where it's not over the top trying to be so different, but yet organically just sort of having a message. And the message was, this is the city we're in today. Oh, yeah, by the way, we're going to be grilling today. And if this is a competition, there's real money involved and real people. But we spent the front part of each episode talking about where we are and why it's different, why it's unique, and culturally what people represent this food and, you know, just the history. And it's tricky because, you know, you can talk about that. You know, there's books written, you know, that are this big. So to do it in you know, 4.5 minutes. But but at the same time, it was really about sending a message to, you know, you're sitting on your couch watching the show. And after that show, you're like, not only am I going to fire up the grill tomorrow and I'm going to try that, but also I'm booking my ticket to New Orleans or I'm booking my ticket to Austin or but, you know, so I'm going to go there.
And I felt like the overriding message also came out, eat local.
That's it.
And we all know how important that is.
Sure.
Now, speaking of eating local, had you ever thought of putting crawfish on the grill?
As you know, there were a lot of common or connected ingredients that are, you know, when you talk about the Deep South, the Gulf South, from Texas all the way to Florida, you know, obviously we share a body of water.
Right.
So it was like, so should we give oysters to such and such? Where should the snapper be? Okay. And I'm like, well, that's all, you know, of course, being from New Orleans, I'm like, that's ours.
Where's the crab going?
Yeah.
Where's the crab going?
Yeah, the blue crab, everything's ours. You know, we want to own it, you know, and take credit for it. So I'm like, oh, well, that could be New Orleans. And you know, Neil's looking at me going, okay, so we have nothing else for any other state. You want it all for Louisiana. I said, okay. So we started sort of splitting hairs and dividing it up a little bit. And, you know, there was crackling and boar and there was crawfish. And, you know, obviously crawfish had to be Louisiana. And there was some, you know, we had alligator in Florida. But, you know, those kind of things. We actually had the farmer herself, 50 years, her and her husband owned the farm, Gatorama. They were on the show because she had her tail meat on the show. So it was just a lot of fun. So talk about being local, we actually have one of the judges judging her own tail meat. So it was it made it that much more intense, but also that much more real.
Okay, now there is another question that I just have to ask you, David, because I feel like I know you so well, and I think so many people in the listening audience knows you as like the very smiley, really kind, good guy,
yeah.
David Kwas.
Yeah.
So how hard was it pulling off that tough guy, chief judge host thing?
You know, it's a great question because it kind of haunted me initially, you know, when they offered me the position. And they're like, well, again, like no other show, we're actually going to have you not only be the host, but you're also going to wear a judge's hat. And so I'm immediately thinking to myself, well, you try to win everybody being the host, you know, no one hates the host, right? So like, okay, well, I'm a host, so I'm, you know, I'll be myself and and hopefully, you know, people will get it and think I'm charismatic and it'll come across, you know, that I'm a decent guy and you know, none of that's going to change. But then all of a sudden I'm sitting down on the table and I'm picking through food and looking at it and listening to them sell me their dish. And it was tricky, you know, because I'd never considered myself an overly critical person. And I think having been on the other side, because I've done a competition show before, it allowed me to judge them more freely because I've been there. And so I think I did a good job. I think I did a good job with sort of throwing out some pointers. But again, these guys and gals are not professional, so I'm not going to sit there and say, you know, the this, the that. So I made it about like just like if I was a neighbor in their house and they asked me after eating their food, like, what did I think? Well, but at the end of the day, it's 10 grand. So it was it was serious.
That's a serious amount of money.
Someone's getting a lot of money, and they're going to have the bragging rights of being the grill master of that city. So every time I sort of reminded myself of that and the sort of the severity of it, I wanted to be fun, lighthearted. But at the end of the day, we're getting ready to award something big to somebody.
Yeah.
And it was that's when the seriousness sort of kicked in.
So what did you learn about yourself in doing this?
Well, talking about the same thing, sort of the balancing of wanting people to sort of see who I am and not sort of mask that. You could do what you do on a 13-hour show and the network's going to clean it up and do what they have to do. And they did a great job capturing me, but also it was a good balance, I think. And, you know, at the end of the day, people have to remember that it's TV and it's but there are always going to be people that are going to judge you. And so that was the tricky part for me because it's one thing to put yourself on your plate and have a restaurant and have guests come in and have their opinion about you. Well, you know, they're probably there either because they heard about you or they're already a fan or they always already like what you do. Now, that's not to say you're resting on your laurels, but you at least have a base of like people that, you know, they're coming there for
love
a reason.
Your food.
Yeah. So like it's almost like having people over at the house, you know, no one's going to come over that hates you, you know, and hates your food and hates everything about you. But now you're out on there in the public eye and you're on TV and it's sort of like, God, you know, there's going to be a good amount of people that just don't like me. And so that's kind of weird.
Oh.
So I sort of, you know, I'm a Gemini, you know, I get sensitive. So I've been told not to let that hinder or fill my head too much, but I do. I care about what people think about me, and I always have. And
just don't read too much of it.
I know.
Just don't pay any attention. You just keep your – that's how I do what I do. I just keep my head down.
That's it.
And I just keep doing what I'm doing.
That's it.
And if I'm making me happy, then
that's
I figure somebody's happy along
with me.
And
no one's ever going to accuse you of being inconsistent or she's this or he's she. So I think that's a wonderful, wonderful advice. So thank you.
You stay genuinely yourself.
That's it.
And it all turns out fine.
Right.
That was Chef David Guas, host of the Travel Channel's American Grill.
Are you ready for the country? Because it's time to go. Are you ready for the country? Because it's time to go.
David Guas isn't the only one who's been uncomfortable at the judges' table. Native New Orleanian and food writer Scott Gold has moderated a number of friendly cooking competitions, but was caught off guard when he found himself alongside professional judges using a sterner set of rules.
Over the years, I've competed in several versions of that great American institution, the cook-off, and have judged many more. While it's usually a lot of fun, I always make sure to approach my judging duties with an appropriate amount of fairness and respect. I thought I was serious about my duties when it came to chili, hot dogs, vegan gumbo, and other comestible competitions, but those were nothing compared to barbecue. Recently, I was called on to be a judge at Hogs for the Cause, a wonderful event filled with wonderful people and wonderful smoked pork. I assumed that taking on the responsibility of judging 90 barbecue teams and their efforts would be similar to the others, a convivial time bubbling with good cheer. I assumed wrong. As it turns out, professional competitive barbecue judging, the kind that happens on the circuit all across America, is extraordinarily serious business. Each judging table necessitated a pro judge to be present among the other five, and there were about 50 judges in total. And all of the pros, from what I could tell, considered each morsel of food with the kind of gravitas you'd find in a murder trial juror. Silent, grim-faced, and simmering with solemnity. The first thing I learned about pro barbecue judging is that the numerical system on which it's based is utterly Byzantine. In each round, be it sauce, beans, ribs, pork butt slash shoulder, or pork paree, every table was tasked with judging six entrants according to four criteria: appearance, flavor, tenderness, and overall impression, each of which would require a whole number score between 6 and 10. After those criteria had been met, the six plates in every round also required an overall score comprised of a decimal number between 7 and 10. Still following me? It gets better. Apparently, the rules have their own set of rules. Giving an entry the score of 7 is considered a death knell, a shameful rating that will throw off the entrant's score enough to essentially disqualify them. I imagined a barbecue chef seeing a 7, then stoically pulling out a short samurai sword and steadying himself to commit seppuku. A 7, explained the head judge, basically means that the dish made you vomit. She explained these rules via microphone in the judge's tent in what was clearly the professional barbecue version of your standard airline safety lecture. 8 means you didn't throw up, she continued. 9 means it's pretty good. And 10 has you going back for seconds. Then, as the pro at my table explained, the overall decimal numbers needed to be doled out in descending order from 9.9 to 9.4. After each judge was finished filling out their form for the round, the table's pro would scrutinize each sheet to ensure that the Kafka-esque requirements had been appropriately satisfied. But a judging system that borders on fascistic wasn't the only thing I found disconcerting. It was the silence. In professional barbecue judges' tents, you are not allowed to speak during the judges' round, or grunt, sigh, make yummy sounds, or emote in any way, lest you intentionally or inadvertently influence the judges beside you. "Don't do that," said one pro, after I'd committed the egregious sin of muttering "oomph" upon digging into a tender pork rib. "That sort of thing will get you kicked out of the judge's tent for good." I imagine the disgraced judge, now a despicable outcast, forced to wander the dusty barbecue hinterlands with a scarlet T embroidered on his clothing, so that all will know to forever shun him for being a talker. By the sixth and final round, pork paree, I'd had about all the judging I could handle. An entire day of barbecue math class is enough to make any sane person want to ensure that the pork isn't the only thing getting sauced. So I skipped the judge's tent to find my friends and accomplish the most important part of the day, drinking beer and enjoying, without fear or judgment, some good old-fashioned American barbecue. The way it should be.
That was food writer Scott Gold. You can find his Food Porn Fridays column each week at nolavie.com. When we come back from the next short break, we'll catch up with Chef Ryan Hughes with the lowdown on his cooking adventures in Russia. Don't go anywhere. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Food blogger Chris Jay is our Louisiana Eats man on the road in the northwestern corner of our delicious state. Chris, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks for having me, Poppy. It's an honor to be back.
What are we eating today?
Well, I wanted to take you to a place called Go-Sickles. It's not your average spot that I like to tell you about because it's a gourmet popsicle shop. It's been open a couple of years. It's found a rabid following in Shreveport-Bossier, and now they've got a food truck that's going to festivals in South Louisiana. So your listeners might be able to see that little purple truck with Go-Sickles on the side anywhere around the state.
Let me guess. It's spelled
G-E-A-U-X. I think it's required to spell go that way now in the state of Louisiana, but it's run by a family. Every member that's involved with the business is a member of the Johnson family. And they do these really creative, kind of adventurous, gourmand-friendly popsicles. You know, it's not your average. There's no grape popsicle at Go-Sickles. It's going to be Hot Passion, for example, is one I love that's got pineapple, jalapeno peppers, and I believe mango, but I'm not sure. But all of the popsicles are handmade concoctions, and they're back there in the kitchen like chemists mixing up new flavors all of the time. The most popular one they have is called the Cookie Maxter. It's a caramel and brown sugar-based kind of cookie-ish flavored pop, but kids go haywire for it. What I love about the place is that they have these ultra-limited editions, and they get it. You know, they know how to promote these things. They're on Facebook and Twitter, and they're, you know, we've got 20 of these pops. It's an experimental batch. Come and get one before they're gone.
Where are they located?
They're located on Uri Drive, which is kind of one of the main shopping drags of Shreveport, so it's super easy to find. They're in an old bank. So you drive through if you don't want to go in.
A drive through.
And you get the pop in one of those like air tube things. It's hilarious. It's this converted old bank. It's wonderful.
Can you get a Go-Sickle 12 months a year?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you asked, because my favorite thing at Go-Sickles is not actually a popsicle. They have concocted this bizarre recipe for citrus mint tea that is just addictive. There must be something addictive in it, because Shreveport Bossier people are just nuts about it. They also do hot cocoa and things like that to kind of keep the business going year-round.
Well, that makes good sense.
But that little truck also is all over the place, whether that's like Pensacola or Houston. They were huge at the Free Press Festival. I heard a huge line there. And I saw them at Festival Acadien this past year, and people were going haywire for them. So they're really trying to get out there and make the truck, you know, kind of the main part of their business.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
You can find our Louisiana Eats roving reporter, Chris J, on his food blog, 20by49.com, or by visiting us at louisianaeatsradio.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. This summer, we spoke with Chef Ryan Hughes before he traveled to the Usadba Jazz Festival in Russia. While he was there, he cooked for thousands of people, but it was a logistical nightmare from the word go.
Poppy, I sent him a list of about 15 different dishes that were good representations of New Orleans or Louisiana or Southern food, let's say that, you know. And I was like, all right, guys, you pick your top two, and then we'll start breaking down recipes, and I'll start teaching you how to do it via Skype and via email. So what do these guys do is, instead of picking two recipes, they email me back immediately, and they're like, okay, we'll take all 12 recipes. Hold on a second. No, we're not doing 12 recipes.
Perhaps he should have considered that a warning. Ever the optimist, Ryan moved forward and stayed in touch with his team of Russian chefs via Skype. When he landed in Moscow after a 14-hour flight, he took some time to soak in the city, then headed out to the festival grounds for two cooking demonstrations in a single weekend. Right from the start, Ryan discovered something had been lost in the translation.
When us as chefs do these cooking demonstrations, we know, you know, it's more for show. We obviously want it to taste great, but there's so many different variables that are there, you know, cooking on stage in front of people. So I was pretty explicit with the guys. You'll have everything else prepared to sell, because we're serving for thousands of people, right? So I get there and just kind of walking around, you know, kind of meandering through the crowd, just talking to people. And a lot of people were expecting us, and they were really excited. So it was fascinating. And then I get up there an hour before I'm supposed to cook on stage my demo, and here's the chef. He pulls out 50 pounds of chicken.
Oh, dear.
You know exactly where I'm going with this.
Yeah. Huh?
What they wanted me to do was to do the cooking demonstration, but also to have the same dish, the jambalaya, to feed 2,000 or 3,000 people all
no.
at once.
No.
I'm not kidding. No, I was like, holy, are you kidding me? So I got a little, I didn't get angry. You don't want to get angry at anything, especially right before you're going to do a cooking demonstration like that. And everybody there was so gracious and great. But I really didn't have a choice. So here they brought out this big cast iron pot, this huge cast iron cauldron, this other kind of lackey. You know, he was like low man on the totem pole at the in the kitchen. He was up there building this huge fire underneath it. So the top Russian news crews were there filming. Russian won.
No pressure.
No. Well, that was cool. It was fine. But of course, I had to make it not only look good and entertaining within, I had just 45 minutes to do this, but to also make it taste decent for 3,000 people because this was their first introduction to Louisiana food at the same time.
I don't know how you did that. How did you do that?
Well, I did it, but
I mean, I can fake the gumbo in 45 and have it taste good.
Exactly.
But it requires a lot of prep.
It's a lot of prep. Well, they had everything cut for me, but they didn't have the stock hot. They were making like this amazing mold wine, you know, so they had a burner like in this little tent. So I ripped off the mold wine, the big pot, and then this Russian guy was looking at me like, what are you doing? I was like, no, we got to get the stock on here right now. And I'm trying to explain to him in English, you know, and my little cute little translator, she was following me around trying to keep up. She's like, oh, my God, this guy's crazy. What is he doing? I was like, no, this is what I've got to do, you know, get the stock hot. You had to make light of it. So I made a big joke of it, you know, just kind of carrying on with people. But what was funny, though, was the musicians on the main stage, we were set up kind of adjacent to it. They kind of caught wind what was going on. And so they just started laughing. They're like, hey, Chef Ryan, when's that going to be ready? Blah, blah, blah. You know, they're kind of making like – they were from New Orleans too.
Oh.
There was a Hot 8 brass band was there and all these other musicians. So it was pretty cool.
So you were under this incredible pressure to cook this jambalaya suddenly in 45 minutes for 3,000 people. And the New Orleans band is catcalling you from the stage.
Catcalling me, yes.
How did it all turn out?
I wanted to do the whole Martha Stewart, Julia Child thing where you turn around and then pop it out of the oven and then boom, you're ready. Because guess what? I didn't have any to do that. So there were people literally, Poppy, waiting in line, 30, 40 people deep, ready to buy this jambalaya off of them. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, what do I do? What do I do? So I sped up the process, added a little bit less stock, and added it as I went to the end just to try to speed it up. Because we all know, you know, to do it, to do a proper Cajun jambalaya, you need a really good hard cook or sear on the chicken and the vegetables. You want that Mylar reaction to happen where you've got some brown bits at the bottom of the pot and you're scraping it. But when you're putting 40 pounds of chicken in there, it's not really browning the way that you want it to brown. Or it's not browning at all. It's basically steaming. And once you got it in there, there's nothing to do. So I put the lid back on it. I grabbed one of the lackeys, the Russian guys. And I'm like, okay, you stand here and you wait till it's done. I got down off the stage and went up to the different media outlets from Russia One. And I did interviews and I walked up and down to the crowd who were waiting, and there were other foods to serve them.
Yeah.
You know, it just wasn't the jambalaya. Thank God. Can you imagine? So I kind of bided our time for a while. I bided an extra half hour, 45 minutes. Actually, what happened, though, was just in the long cooking process of it, the rice actually overcooked a little bit on there. So that even bugged me even more. I'm like, are you kidding me? I went through all this, and here's the rice being overcooked a little bit. You can't do it like that. You know, not jambalaya that big.
I'd like to tell you that this story has a happy ending, but when Ryan showed up to cook gumbo on stage, it was deja vu all over again. There's always going to be some miscommunication when crossing cultures, but once the stress of the festival was over, Ryan went on to cook Louisiana style for 16 days all across Russia.
So the second week I was going around, I would go meet people and I would have to actually ask for directions, and I'd point to my phone like a picture. Every single person, they would actually get off the subway stop a stop or two early just to show me off of where I should go. Complete strangers.
Oh.
And they knew I was American. They said, you know, the people that I was with, they said they could spot me a mile away just from being American, how I looked and whatnot. But they were just more than gracious.
That's Chef Ryan Hughes, owner and operator of Purlieu, a pop-up restaurant in New Orleans. To see photos of Ryan's Russian trip, visit our website at wwno.org. It's
Jambalaya is one of Louisiana's most emblematic foods, yet it's also a dish that's often poorly prepared and can be a challenge to even really good cooks. After hearing about Ryan's frustrating experience cooking jambalaya in Russia, I thought a Louisiana Eats jambalaya discussion was way in order. Really, y'all, it's not that hard. The word jambalaya is said to come from the French word for ham, jambon, an African dialect word for rice, ya, and the Akkadian, where everything is a la this and a la that. So jambalaya literally is ham with rice and a little bit of everything. That said, everything but the kitchen sink can land up in jambalaya, so it's easy to personalize for your own taste. I make my jambalaya with three meats, a spicy fresh charisse, a good smoked andouille, and some tasso ham. The charisse comes out of the casing and goes into the heavy iron pot first. I break it into pieces, almost like ground beef, and brown it. It will render some grease to help with the rest of the browning. Add the sliced andouille and diced tasso to the charisse and let them get good and brown too. Add chopped onions, celery, and bell pepper to the browned meat and get a little brown edge on them too. Now it's time for the rice, and this is where it can get tricky. Measure the rice to make sure that you add double the amount of liquid. Add the dry raw rice to the meats and seasonings and sauté it till it gets translucent. Now, add water or stock with a minimal stir. Add thyme, bay leaf, and garlic. Bring everything to a boil and cover well before turning the heat down as low as it'll go. Let the jambalaya cook undisturbed for 25 minutes, and that means no stirring. After 25 minutes, turn off the heat, remove the lid, and using a fork, fluff in some thinly sliced green onions. Cover again for 5 more minutes before tasting to adjust for salt and pepper. Follow these instructions and you'll have perfect jambalaya every time, I promise. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
Jambalaya and a crawfish pie and a Billy gumbo. Yeah, tonight I'm gonna see Mama Shadamio. He get caught and a Billy fruit jar. We're gonna be gale. The son of a gun, we're gonna have a little fun on the bayou. Yeah!
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, and Linda Green, the Yakima Lady Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.